Anyway, thank you all for being here. So the theme for these conversations in June, the four Sundays in June, is sort of broadly grace and the beloved community. If you were at the 8:30 service, you heard this theme of grace. If you're going to 11 o'clock, you will hear it. We'll talk about it today. So the first topic is, you know, what is grace? And I really mean it to be a conversation. I will share things with you to give you things to talk about, but I do want it to be a conversation. So today is, you know, what is grace and how does that work? And I'm going to draw upon, as I said at 8:30, my favorite new dead friend. Gerald May was a psychiatrist who practiced psychiatry for 25 years. He's a Christian. But then he gave up his practice to work at the Shalem Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, and wrote wonderful stuff on the intersection of psychology and Christian faith and spirituality. So I'm going to draw from a book called Addiction and Grace. And you may wonder what addiction has to do with the rest of us, with most of us. The answer is everything. So that'll be the conversation for today, to understand how grace works in and through the preoccupations and addictions that all of us have. Next week, June 14th, is Flag Day. We thought, what better time to talk about this whole question of how the Christian community relates to the larger community, sort of church and state. Always an interesting subject. And so we'll talk about that next week. A couple more conversations about who's in and who's out, and looking in and looking out, how spirituality relates to serving the larger world. And all of that will tee up three conversations in July after taking the 4th of July weekend off. The Peace and Justice team has a wonderful series lined up on the whole question of race and justice and caring in our society. So, got a great summer lined up for you. Thanks for being here today. Let's begin, as we always do, with a prayer. Gracious God, we thank you for your presence among us. We thank you for your church, where we gather to hear your word and to grow together with one another. We pray that your spirit might move in and through us in this hour and always, so that our hearts might become more gracious, even as your heart is gracious, so that we might reflect your love and grace and mercy in the world. So guide us now and always, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so let's start from talking about grace. For the moment, we'll free associate. What do you think of when you think of grace? What kinds of characteristics come to mind when you think about grace? By the way, I have a custom, which is I always ask a question, count down 4 seconds of awkward silence. So everybody looks around and they say, thank God. And then after the 4 seconds of awkward silence are over, feel free to jump in. So we're asking, you know, what is grace? What comes to mind? 4, 3, 2, 1. What's that? A gift, somebody says. Gift. Yes, absolutely. A gift. All right.
Love.
Humility. Interesting. First of all, gift, because as we're saying out here, a gift is not something that you earn. It's just given by the grace of the person. Where does humility relate to that? It does, of course.
I think it's more the receiver.
That in order to receive a gift, I'm going to repeat what people say just so you can hear. Molly's saying that if you receive a gift, that it takes a certain amount of humility to receive it, right? You ever see two guys fighting over the check at a restaurant, right? This is my example of anti-humility, right? Because it looks like it's generosity, right? Oh, let me get it. No, let me get it. Well, let me get it. No, I'll get it. And after a while, you know, what starts out appearing to be generosity turns into a fight, because it's not really about being gracious about a gift. It's really about sort of dominance and power, right? I'm going to pay, I'm going to be in charge, and all I am. And these guys will start fighting about who's going to be the more generous. And what's missing in all of that is the humility to receive a gift, right? Sometimes you actually give somebody a gift by letting them give you a gift. See what I mean? You know, the humility to let other people do things for you actually can be a gift to people as well. So if somebody offers to pick up the check, let them do it, because you're just giving them a gift, right? All right, gift, humility, what else goes to mind? Jess?
Freedom.
Freedom, why?
Because when you receive God's grace, everything is lifted away.
Jeff's saying freedom because when you receive God's grace, everything is lifted away. What kinds of things get lifted away?
Well, the work that you might have had if you were going through a tough time, and if you stay with God, you just know that it's empty.
So going through troubled times, many of us have done that, probably all of us one way or another. If you really do trust in God, you trust in the grace of God, you know God is going to be with you, and that is a very freeing thing, isn't it?
Yes.
The deeper that goes, the more free you can become of anxiety about how it's going to go. Doesn't mean you necessarily know how it's going to turn out, but you do know that God is going to be with you. Great. Anybody else? Yeah, please.
What about forgiveness?
Forgiveness. What about forgiveness?
Well, we need it on a daily basis, and so we need the grace of God to be forgiven on a daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Carol's saying we need God's forgiveness on a daily basis. Any of us who are at all self-aware know that we keep messing up. But every time we do that, rather than turning that into self-deprecation and the burden of guilt, if it points us back to the grace of God, then our very failures become additional occasions for gratitude, because instead of wallowing in guilt, we're pointed to the God who is gracious and loves us. So God has designed the world in such a way that the good stuff is good, and the bad stuff points us back to God, and that turns out to be good too. It doesn't mean that the bad stuff is good, but it does mean that even when the bad stuff happens, and even when we do the bad stuff, if we're open to grace, it points us back to the God who loves us. Great. Anybody else? Yes, please.
Abundance.
How does abundance work? Yeah, John's saying grace is unlimited, it's abundant. I've done a lot of work in economics, and one of the sort of axioms of economics is that resources are scarce, and so economics is all about, you know, pricing and supply and demand in a realm of scarcity. And so all of us that deal with the real world economically tend to think in terms of scarcity. Everything has a price, somebody gets it, somebody doesn't, some people win, some people lose. Grace is completely different from all of that. It's just utterly abundant. It's everywhere. It's like the air. The air that you use doesn't take away from the air that I use. It's just abundant. So it cuts across the whole grain of our thinking in terms of scarcity. That's great. Did you have a comment on that?
Grace comes karma.
Great. What about karma?
Karma.
Grace trumps karma. Good. All right. I like that. Karma being the Eastern notion that, you know, what goes around comes around. You do good stuff, you get good stuff back in this life and the next life. You do bad stuff, you get bad stuff. Grace trumps all that. It says no. You do good stuff, that's better. You do bad stuff, God forgives and redeems and makes you better. It trumps karma. I like that. So that's a bumper sticker. Grace trumps karma. I like that. I don't usually like bumper stickers.
That's okay.
Anybody else? All right, that's only the first question. Jack?
Hope.
Hope. Yeah, Jack is saying, through grace we have hope, right? I mean, you screw up, and if it's all about me and I'm screwing up, then I can just think, oh man, this is never going to get right. But grace says, well, okay, yeah, you messed that up, that's all right. But you can start over, because God loves, God forgives, God makes new, and so there's hope, there's always hope. Most of you, I've been around long enough to come watch it if that tells me how long I've been here. I'm coming up on 9 years, and so you probably heard most of my stories, but you remember the book I'm Okay, You're Okay, when it came out in the 70s? You probably heard me say this, but Bill Coughlin was the chaplain at Yale at the time, and he talked with a bit of a list. I'd love to do Bill Coughlin invitations, so I had an excuse I get to do that one. So this book came out, I'm Okay, You're Okay, and it was one of those sort of pop psychology things from the 70s, you know, I'm okay, you're okay, it's all okay, it doesn't matter what you do. Bill Coughlin, who's kind of swashbuckling chaplain at Yale, got up to the pulpit and said, now there's this new book out, it's called I'm Okay, You're Okay. But the truth is, I'm not okay, and you're not okay, but that's okay. And it's okay because God loves you, because there's hope, right? So instead of pretending it's all okay, no, it's not okay, it's all messed up. I'm not okay, you're not okay, but that's okay, because God loves you. For this reason. One or two more? Yes, please, Dan. How do I surrender? I'm saying it's not just about what we can do, but about who God is and what God can do through us. Surrender has sort of negative connotations, you know, in our culture, because we want to succeed, we want to win. Surrendering means you lose. But in this case, you know, spiritually, surrender is more like, it's more like trimming your sails to the wind. It's more like extending your wings so that you can fly. You give into a power greater than yourself, the wind, the Spirit of God, and it enables you to do things you could never do by yourself. So that's great. All right, since that's only the first question, I have three more pages to go. Let's keep moving. All right, so related to that, let's describe gracious people. We've been talking about what grace is. Can you think of a person that you know that you would call gracious? What is that person like? Kind? Yeah.
They think of other people.
They think of other people, yeah. They're not just sort of asking, how am I doing? They're looking around saying, you know, how are you? What can I do? You know, they think of generous things.
They reach out.
They reach out, yes. Yeah, that's right. They actually do stuff. Right. Or say they're low maintenance. You sound like you actually know somebody like that, right? Explain that a little bit. What a gracious person is low maintenance. How do you mean?
It doesn't take much to be in the presence, being a company that's very intimate.
Yeah. This is good. We like being around low maintenance people, right? They don't take a lot of care, right? They're pleasant to be around. They're not demanding stuff from you all the time. They're all caught up in themselves, sucking energy out. No, they're just pleasant to be around because you don't have to be fixing them all the time. That's wonderful. Anybody else? Yeah, please. Yeah. That's right. They do things without expectation of reward. They're not doing it to be boastful. They're just doing it because they're kind. They're thought. Yeah,
they didn't
say
giving?
They didn't say it. It was sort of implied. Giving, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so we know gracious people. And you want to be like that, don't you? You don't want to be high maintenance. You don't want to be whiny. You don't want to be self-centered. You want to be the kind of person that you think of when you think of a gracious person. All right. I'm going to spend a couple minutes talking about some things that Jerry May says. I knew people who knew him. He is the younger half-brother, he passed away in 2005. He's the younger half-brother of Rollo May. People that have read in psychology and philosophy will have known Rollo May, who was more famous. But 30 years after Rollo May was born, their father, I guess, remarried and had Gerald May. And I've read Rollo May stuff too. I like him a lot. But Jerry May, I'm a huge fan of now. And one of his books is called Addiction and Grace, because he did, as a psychiatrist, addiction counseling, among other things. I did a little presentation for a program at Western Psych a few weeks ago for social workers and mental health professionals and so forth. I was on a panel, actually, with a Buddhist monk and a rabbi. Sounds like a joke, yeah. It's like a rabbi, a monk, and a minister walked into a psyche. But I mentioned this book by Jerry May, and all the addictions counselors' heads were nodding vigorously, and somebody said, you know, it's the best book that he's ever read on the subject. So we're going to tell you why in the next few minutes. That's not just for people with problems with drugs and alcohol, but it's for all of us. So Jerry May points out, as a Christian who's also a psychiatrist, he says that that everybody has this sort of inborn desire for God. Everybody has a longing for God. Augustine famously said, our hearts are restless till they rest in you. But that sin turns us away from love through two primary kinds of forces. The first one is repression, and that's a psychological term that you're familiar with if you know anything about psychology. Repression is when people sort of squash something down, sort of lock it in the basement, because they don't want to deal with it. And May says that people fairly routinely repress a desire for love, for example, because love makes it vulnerable, right? I've been loading music onto an iPod. I'm on the cutting edge of 1994 in my technology. So I got an iPod the other day, and I'm loading all my Simon and Garfunkel stuff on it. And so I've been singing, I'm a rock, I'm an island, right? If any Simon and Garfunkel fans know that. It's, I don't need love, I have my books and poetry to protect me. I am a rock, I am an island. Well, that's repression, right? Everybody needs love. But because love is scary, if I risk loving you and you don't love me back, or you don't do what I want, then I'm vulnerable, so I'm just going to avoid all that by repressing my desire for love. And May says that people repress their desire for God for similar reasons. Because so much of our self-esteem hangs on our self-image as being successful and things that we deserve and so forth. And if people have this fear, and rightly so, that if they look to God for love and self-esteem, they're going to have to give up some stuff. Nothing that really matters. They have to give up stuff that gets in the way. But it's scary. It makes you vulnerable. And so people repress their desire for God in a way similar to how some people repress their desire for love. So that's sort of interesting. And then they focus on other things, safer things. So since God is scary, since that would require a complete transformation of who I am, I'll focus on other stuff, like being successful in my business, and being funny, and having people like me, and looking good, and trying to look younger. And I'm gonna turn my attention from my self-esteem and my security to other safer things that I can manage, because it's just too scary to hand myself over to God. So one thing that we use to sort of avoid dealing with God in the same way that we avoid dealing with love is depression. The other thing, though, and what the book is mostly about, is addiction. So we'll talk about addiction for a few minutes. He says, while repression stifles desire, addiction attaches desire. It bonds and enslaves the energy of desire to specific behaviors, things, or people. Attachment is a big word in the tradition of spiritual formation and in psychology as well. It comes from the French attaché, meaning nailed to. So a diplomatic attaché, sort of, nailed to the mission, tied to the mission. Attachments are things that we nail certain desires to. We attach certain strong primitive desires within us to specific objects. And when we do that, we form addictions in ways that we'll talk about in a minute. And then addiction, of course, becomes the enemy of freedom because, by definition, an addiction is something that we feel we can't do without. More about that in a minute. But May's point is that addictions can turn out to be an occasion for blessing because they show us the limits of our own capability. They prove to us that we are not gods after all, that the things that we try to use to our own identity and self-esteem fail us, and then when we hit the bottom, as addicts sometimes say they do, then we're open to new possibilities. And so our addictions can create space where grace comes in. And that's the theme of the whole book, that the way you get over an addiction of any sort is to bottom out, realize the limitations of your own ability, and then create a space where grace can move in. He defines addiction as any compulsive, habitual behavior that limits the freedom of human desire, and it is caused by the attachment or nailing of desire to specific objects. Once again, addiction is any compulsive, habitual behavior that limits the freedom of human desire. Compulsive, habitual behavior. And he describes five essential qualities of addiction. I'll mention them briefly, then we're going to talk some more. He says five essential characteristics of addiction include, first of all, tolerance. And tolerance doesn't mean accepting one another. Tolerance is the physiological and psychological situation in which it takes more and more of the stimulus to achieve the desired result, right? So you know about alcohol. You start drinking, you feel okay, maybe it takes your mind off what's going on. After a while, your body builds up tolerance to the alcohol, so you need more alcohol to achieve the same effect. Drugs, same thing with other kinds of addictions that will come in for a moment. So tolerance is the first characteristic of addiction. Second one that he describes is withdrawal symptoms, and you know about that. As your body builds up tolerance, you need more and more of whatever it is you're addicted to achieve the same result and make you feel good. When you don't get it, you start to go through withdrawal. And most of us have heard about people that have the shakes or something when they're going through or suffer in other ways from a physiological addiction. And the reason for that, there are a couple reasons for it, but one of them is that when the body gets accustomed to having a certain stimulus, alcohol or drugs or love for that matter, we'll talk about that in a minute, when it is withdrawn, the body has a sort of panic reaction, a stress reaction. Oh, where is this thing that I've gotten accustomed to needing? And so it goes into stress. And the irony is that because you've learned to turn to this thing you're attached to relieve your stress, the more stress you have, the more you turn to the thing you wanted to use to relieve your stress. So it becomes a sort of vicious cycle, right? I have a withdrawal, and the withdrawal causes me to want more of the very thing that I'm missing because it's a reaction to stress caused by my withdrawal. You see? So addictions become sort of compounding as withdrawal causes stress, which then causes us to want more of the stuff. A third quality is self-deception. Anybody that's ever worked with alcoholics, recovering alcoholics, I have to say, are some of my favorite people in the world. Because they're just smart, you know, they just know stuff. And you can't get away with stuff because they'll see you rationalizing things, you know? I'd give up drinking if my wife wasn't so awful, you know? I'd give up the stuff if my job wasn't so hard. I would stop if only this or that. And sit around in a room with recovering alcoholics, and it's just kind of fun to watch them sort of cut through their own and everybody else's rationalizations. But self-deception is a huge aspect of addiction, because if you're going to keep doing this, you got to tell yourself that it's not your fault that you're doing this. It's not your fault that you're out of control here. You got to tell yourself whatever it takes to keep getting yourself the thing that you're addicted to. And we're going to see how all this plays out, not just in regard to substances, but other things too. So, tolerance, withdrawal symptoms, self-deception, loss of willpower, that's sort of self-evident. After a while, you can't help yourself. I don't want to do this. I've known a lot of people with, let's say, alcohol issues. And so you lose your job, and your wife hates you, and your kids don't like you anymore, and you just hate yourself. I've got to stop. But then you just can't. You go back and you drink some. So you lose your willpower. Paul, in a very different setting, has a wonderful passage where he says, "You know, wretched man that I am, I do the things that I don't want to do, I don't do the things that I want to do, who will deliver me from this body of death?" He's not talking about substance addiction, but it's the same thing. You just lose your willpower because part of you wants something, part of you doesn't want it, and so you're at war with yourself. And finally, distortion of attention. We've all heard kids who steal from their own mothers and grandmothers to buy drugs for them. You know, who would steal from their grandmother? Well, if you really, really needed the high, and you built up tolerance so that you need more and more of it, you might even steal from your own grandmother to do that. And you do that by a distortion of attention. You're so focused on the thing that you're addicted to that it doesn't occur to you that stealing from grandma is a bad thing. Or if it does occur to you, you repress that thought because I really, really need to get it. Okay? So, five qualities of addiction. Once again, tolerance, withdrawal symptoms, self-deception, loss of willpower, distortion of attention. We've been talking about substance abuse because that's the easy and obvious thing. Here's a question. What other kinds of things do you find people being addicted to that have some or all of those same qualities? Affluence. Tourists. Trophies. Houses, cars, clothes, country clubs, affluence, right? Can you kind of smell the qualities in that? Tolerance? People that get, Tony out east, Eastern 99 College. Tony Campolo, yeah. Talks about affluenza, right? It's a good word, affluenza. So if you have affluenza, is tolerance a problem? You're addicted to trophies and stuff? How does that work? I'm going to play this out as an example. I'm not getting away from substances to sort of other stuff. How does tolerance work in affluenza? You never have enough, yeah. Right? I grew up in the Mont Valley where you can sort of tell a person's social status by what kind of GM car they drove, right? So if you were just going to labor in the mill, you drove a Chevy. If you had a little better job, you're an electrician or something, maybe you drove a Pontiac. If you did a little better than that, you'd drive a Buick. Maybe you're kind of a low-level manager. If you do a little better than that, you drive an Oldsmobile. And if you actually run the plant, you drive a Cadillac, right? And in the Mont Valley, you could actually peg where people were in the social hierarchy. And GM built their cars that way. I mean, that was not coincidental. They built their cars to know that you could move up Because if you're doing pretty well, the Chevy's not good enough anymore, you got to have the Buick. Or the Oldsmobile, if you're really doing well, you got to have the Cadillac, right? People talk about money, right? Ogie Hunt, the guy who cornered the silver market back in the 80s, and actually caused the prices. Imagine, one guy caused the price of silver to fluctuate because he had so much control of it. The Congress hauled him before some committee to testify, and he said in his Texas drawl, he said, well, you know, with inflation being what it is, $1 billion isn't what it used to be. It's like, okay, you got $1 billion, well, somebody has $2 billion. You have $2 billion, somebody has $10 billion. And then there's Bill Gates, you know? There's always somebody that has more, okay?
Well, people may remember George Carlin had a wonderful routine of, you buy a house to hold your stuff. And then you get more stuff, and you have to buy a bigger house. And then you have to buy more stuff to build a bigger house, and then you need a bigger house.
Yeah.
And then it's snowballs.
Exactly, right. So, without belaboring the point too much more, yes, tolerance absolutely applies. You need more stuff. Withdrawal symptoms. How does withdrawal affect affluenza? If you feel like you're not keeping up, then you get depressed, right? Because you need the struggles, right? So you got this big deal job, and then what? Somebody buys your company and lays you off. You don't need two CEOs, you only need one, right? Or, you know, you retire and you don't have all the sort of status that you used to have. You don't have quite the same income that you used to have. Or bad stuff happens, and whatever it was that was making you feel secure because of all the prestige, all the trophies and stuff, you're not getting those. There's some smart young guy that's coming up and taking over. And so you get depressed, right? Because your self-esteem was tied to that. Withdrawal symptoms, right?
You always see that somebody else has something you
want. Yeah, exactly. Somebody else always has something that you want. And it could be money, it could be cars, it could be house, it could be the trophy wife, you know, trophy husband now, I suppose. Self-deception. How does self-deception play into, say, affluenza?
You think they're all there is?
You think that's all there is?
That's the only score.
It's the only scorecard that counts. Which also ties into its fifth criteria, which is the distortion of attention. Everything is about keeping the scorecard there. Right? But also, you have to tell yourself stuff to rationalize, right? You have to tell yourself that you deserve. I'm going to go slightly out on the limb. I don't think this is super dangerous here. The whole CEO compensation thing, right? I don't remember the numbers. But back in the 50s, you know, what the average American CEO would make? 25 times or something, the wage of the average worker. Now what's the number? 300 times? 400 times? So are we 15 or 20 times more productive now because we're paying the top people 400 times instead of 25 times? Really? Are we that much more productive? No. Well, why is it? Well, because everybody sits around on everybody else's board, and CEO Smith over here is making $5 million, so CEO Jones says, I'm worth as much as Smith, and so Jones gets $6 million. And then Smith says, well, Jones is getting $6 million, I should be getting $10 million, right? Like athletes, right? We got some 23-year-olds who play a game that I played every day just for fun, you know, baseball. Somebody gets a contract for, you know, $10 million over 5 years, well, I'm worth more than that guy. I should get $15 million for 5 years, right?
Well, the corporation is really very cohesive policy that makes sense out of that. It just ignores the
world.
Yeah,
right.
In that world, it makes sense.
Exactly. They're saying, in that world, it makes sense. You create a set of rationalizations that justify what you want. To other people, it looks like a kind of self-deception. You tell yourself you really need this. When in fact, you could probably get by with, you know, if you're making $10 million, you probably could get by with $5 million. Okay? Bill Gates, and you got $60 million, even if you give $1 billion, I mean, yeah. And you give away $30 billion and you look like the most generous guy in the world, then you're left to sort of, you know, slouch along with $30 billion. Really? Okay. And then and lots of willpower, because after a while, it just sort of dominates your life, right? I mean, you got to live for this.
And it's fragile.
And it's fragile. All right, so we've been beating up on affluenza a bit, but appropriately so, because it is one of the great addictions of our day. What else? What else do people get addicted to? Thanks, Chuck. Okay, being a good Christian. People get addicted to being a good Christian. Say more about that, because that's really interesting. He's repressing. John is repressing the desire to say more about this. No, it's a wonderful observation, though. Oh, was it? He says it was my sermon. I don't remember that, but that was, what, half an hour ago. It's a great point. How can people be addicted to being a good Christian? Do we need to do the 4-second opera countdown? Go ahead, Bob. Yeah, let me repeat so you can hear. Bobby's sort of teasing out John's idea a little bit, which is you can get addicted to whatever your image of being a good Christian is, doing a lot of stuff, right? Being on all kinds of committees, running stuff, sort of, because other people admire that, yeah, but even less obvious than that, you want to look good in God's eyes, you want to look good in your own eyes, you want to feel like, well, I'm doing what I need to do. But you see that so often in churches. We sometimes say that churches will take their best people, it's like in a Western, take their best people, it's like a horse in a Western where you ride the horse into the ground and then shoot it, you know? You take your best people, you get them to do more and more stuff, you were in charge of that committee, well, I'm in charge of this committee, why don't you teach Sunday school, why don't you run the mission program, why don't you do all this stuff, you ride your horse into the ground, they get burned up, and then you shoot them. And lots of people actually leave churches because they were addicted to showing that they were a good, faithful Christian, and then they wore themselves out, and that turned out to be not altogether unlike an addiction to anything else. Really great. Yeah, please.
You know, I also think it has to do with, it's almost like the addiction to a substance, because it feels good to do that.
Yeah.
A lot of people that you're describing, it wasn't the church that demanded that of them. They felt good doing it, therefore they added more and more and more.
Yeah, that's right. Zed is pointing out that it's not that the church necessarily imposes on people. Sometimes some people ask for it because it feels good. You get a little squirt of whatever that chemical is, you know, dopamine or some kind of endorphin. It says, wow, this feels good. And so you like that little squirt, and you do more stuff to get more squirts of dopamine. Next thing you know, you're kind of addicted to being a good Christian.
Well, I think there's another reason maybe that people feel they have so much. And compared to the broad world, and they feel maybe a little guilt. And so this is a way to try to make up for that.
Great. Flo is suggesting that some people will feel like they're doing really well in the world, and they have some awareness that other people are not doing so well. And so there's a little guilt about that. And so to offset the guilt, you try to do some good things to make yourself feel better, kind of related to that. You get the little squirt of dopamine because it takes away the guilt feeling, saying, wow, I've got so much, these people have so little, I want to feel better about that, so I'll spend more time volunteering to do so. Yeah. We've got a lot of therapists sitting in this section. So there's great insights coming out of here. Marilyn's pointing out who is a therapist. That people also focus on these things to deny other aspects of themselves that are less likable, less beautiful. So yeah, I'm going to focus on what a charitable volunteer I am so as not to pay attention to other stuff. And lots of abuses come up, pedophilia and lots of other things. Yeah, Ted.
A little bit broader than just traditional organized religions, a lot of cults operate on generating a state of spiritual bliss for people that people seek more and more hits of. And they just lose their identity to that, and this is how cults or different sort of spiritually addictive sorts of things operate.
Yeah, absolutely. Some places really cultivate, well, it's an interesting word, even cultivate a certain kind of feeling, and people want that.
Yeah. When it feels good, you can focus on different kinds of outcomes.
Ah.
Therefore, you can be very busy, but not too much thinking.
Interesting. Then saying when it feels good, you can focus more on activity than on outcomes. We all know people that are just so kind of pleased with how busy they are. They don't necessarily produce much, but they feel good about how busy they are, right?
Yeah. All right, please. I think we're trying to find questions, a lot of these things, but also feeling of guilt. And there's something that you use something to relieve that feeling of guilt, and that is really involved. But clearly, if you're not involved for a reason, I guess you're involved to relieve that sense of guilt.
And Doug's saying that we do a lot of this stuff again to relieve a sense of guilt. So I'm saying, again, Jerry Mesa's addiction is anything that we use to try to fill the hole, the God-shaped hole in our soul that really only God can fill. It's like a little kid who gets one of those, you know, one of those little block things with different shaped blocks and tries to stick the stuff in the hole. And you can watch a little kid trying to stick the square thing in the round hole and then stick the star-shaped thing. We do that as big people, trying to squeeze some other thing in the God-shaped hole, and only God fits in the God-shaped hole. Let me say one more example, because we got a lot to cover in the next 20 minutes. Love, particularly romantic love, but also parental love, right? Huge occasion for addiction. Let's talk about that. I meet lots of people, you probably say more young women than young men, I don't know if that's true, let me just sort of make up an example, which is not entirely hypothetical. A young woman who goes with a guy who treats her badly. And so they're together for a while, and then he says, sorry, Janie, it's just not working. It takes off for a while. She's heartbroken. And all her friends are saying, well, dump the guy. He's a jerk. And so she thinks she's dumped him for a while. And then he calls back and says, I miss you so much. Let's get together again. She's right back with him. All the friends are kind of shaking their head. She's with him for a while. This time it's going to work. 3 months later, he dumps her again. You've known people like this, or you read books where people like this show up. I've seen a lot of these people. And people kind of scratch their heads, and they say, what's going on here? Why doesn't you just dump the guy? He's a jerk. Well, it turns out that it has to do with the nature of addiction. Because there is a principle that says, of course, the law of effect, that if a behavior is associated with pleasure, we tend to do more of it. If it's associated with pain, we tend to avoid it. And so, unconsciously, physiologically, the brain starts to wire itself in such a way that whatever the stimulus is that causes me to feel good, I want more of that. And so if it happens to be this guy, Joe, you know, who's making Janie's life terrible, Janie's brain gets wired such that she expects Joe to be a source of happiness. And the interesting thing about addiction is the stress of losing Joe temporarily creates withdrawal symptoms and stress in Janie, and she's gotten accustomed to dealing with her stress by seeking Joe. So one of the things that Dave points out is that intermittent enjoyment of the things we're addicted to is actually stronger than the steady enjoyment of it, because the intermittent enjoying of those things alternates times when you actually get the satisfaction of being with the person, in this case, followed by times of stress by not having the person, followed by the relief of the stress by having the person again, and you can go a long, long time in relationships that are on again often. See that? So when people are sort of baffled by, why don't you just dump the guy? It's because a kind of addiction has set in, and oddly enough, intermittent success and enjoyment is actually more powerful than ongoing success. Gambling, same thing, right? My math teacher in high school said the state lotteries are a tax imposed upon the mathematically challenged. And gambling casinos are a private version of the same thing, right? You know the state sets the way the lottery works because, on average, you're going to lose. That's the whole point, right? They wouldn't have a lottery unless, on average, you're going to lose, so they could use the money for senior citizens or whatever. The casino only has all those games because, on average, you're going to lose. They would not be in business if, on average, you were going to win. So 1 minute of thought about that says gambling, except a little bit for fun, if you can take it or leave it, is just silly. It's just dumb. But how do people get addicted? Well, I go, and I lose $20 this time, but then I win $30. Wow, okay, so I won $30, so maybe next time I'm going to win some more. So I lose $50, well then I double down, and then I lose $100. But it's okay, because I had won before, and the next time, I win $110. And it's the same thing as Janie and Joey. It's, I won once, I like that feeling. Yeah, I lost a couple times, he dumped me. The roulette wheel dumped me, the lever thing that I pulled dumped me, but then I won again. And so the intermittent enjoyment of the sensation, followed by the loss of it, which creates stress, which then creates a desire for the sensation, and then it's fed again, casinos know this, they're onto that. Which is why people become addicted to gambling, just as they become addicted to romance. Thomas? Yeah?
Yeah, in the addiction field, they're called the same thing. Because a lot of times people are in recovery, they're sober for 10 years, 8 years, and they say, well, I guess I must not really have this issue. Well, I can control this clearly,
right.
I can have a drink. You know, so
right.
You see that same flow in the addictions.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, please go ahead.
Very similar to thrill seeking. There was a recent story about a guy who does cliff diving who actually dived into a rock wall and is deceased, but people get such a rush from thrills like that that they are compelled to seek their own destruction ultimately.
Yeah, Ted's pointing out, you know, thrill seekers, guys that jump off cliffs with wings and stuff, more and more dangerous stuff, and not too long ago somebody was kind of famous for that, actually. That's cool. I like the line from Garrison Keillor. Anybody listen to Prairie Home Companion? Been on for like 40 years. Yeah, Keillor, I like Keillor a lot. He says, he was now in his 60s or something when he said this years ago. He said, you know, some of us when we were young, we took drugs to seek the high. But now, many of us find that we can achieve the same effect just by standing up too fast. And the really sad thing about that was, I understood what he meant. And I'm guessing from the laughter, some of you knew too, right? Right? Used to seek thrills by, you know, shooting up drugs and stuff, but now I find if I just stand up too fast, I can get sort of the same effect. All right. Now, the point of all this is, or a point of all this is, you can see how people get addicted to stuff. Anything that feels like it's going to create some stimulation, anything that's going to make me feel good, is a candidate for addiction, which means basically any good thing in the world. And that is the Christian insight, psychologically put, of idolatry. Idolatry is when we make anything that's not God, God. Meaning by that, I mean, of course people don't bow down to their money or to their gambling or to their, you know, loved ones. Not literally. But, maybe some do. On that subject, by the way, listen to pop romantic music sometimes. Maybe not the current stuff. But older romantic music. And how much of that is framed as, you are my everything, I can't live without you. You know, how much of that is, if you took it literally, simply idolatry? You are my everything, I can't live without you, you are my God. Now, of course, it's not meant to be taken literally. But if it were taken literally, it would be manifested idolatry.
But it's the only thing.
Yeah.
It is the
exactly. When it's the only thing, it really is idolatry. So, the classic Christian insight about idolatry is, when you make anything that isn't God into God, meaning it absorbs all your attention, you get withdrawal if you don't have it, you build up tolerance, you need more and more of it, you do self-deceptive stuff to make yourself keep at it. When you start doing those things for anything that isn't God, then you're probably, at least on the outskirts of idolatry, you may be full-blown into it. Now, it's not just that God gets ticked off at that and will punish you. It's that it's not good for us, right? Addictions are not good for us because they keep us from finding the one thing that will fill the God-shaped hole, and that, of course, is God. But the world is full of good stuff, and the irony, of course, is that God made the good stuff. And so part of the trick of spiritual maturity is to learn to accept and enjoy the gifts without substituting them for the giver, right? But the gifts tend to eclipse the giver, and the more gifts we have, the easier it is to eclipse the giver, right? Which is why a lot of people who are quite comfortable in the world have a relatively superficial, shallow faith. When people go on mission trips, you know, I've been to Haiti, Bolivia, Honduras, Malawi, a bunch of places where people are really, really poor. And sort of affluent white folks from the suburbs always come back from those trips and say stuff like, they have so little, but they're so happy. You know? And partly I think people sometimes say that to me. So it's okay that they don't have much. And I can enjoy what I have because they're actually very happy. So part of that is one of those self-deceiving rationalizations. But part of it is the fact that, you know, if you're just barely getting by, you don't have a lot of things that can become idols for you. All you have is God. You can't make an idol out of your car or your income or your fancy title or your big house or your fancy vacation or your trophy wife or your trophy husband. You can't make those an idol because you don't have those things. All you've got is God. Turns out, if that's all you have and you really draw upon that, that actually makes you happy. So it isn't the kind of self-serving rationalization that says, well, we're doing well, therefore, but hey, that's okay because we're poor. No, it is that if you don't have things that are candidates for idolatry, you tend to be less idolatrous. Now, the irony, the danger, of course, is as people's living improves, the temptation for idolatry grows with them. So the task of spiritual maturity, if you're in a relatively comfortable situation, is how to appreciate and be grateful for gifts without letting them take the place of the giver in the devotion. That's fine. Okay, a couple more things. Let's see. There are attraction addictions and aversion addictions. So, I mean, I kind of knew this, but I didn't have it framed in quite this way. So attraction addictions are the obvious things. You know, Jeannie has an attraction addiction to Joey. Affluents and sufferers have attractions to all kinds of stuff. Alcoholics have attractions to alcohol. Sure, we know what attraction addictions are. Aversion addictions are interesting because these are things that we love to be against. Negative attractions, phobias, for example. If you're obsessively concerned about some fear, there's a sort of weird attraction there. You know, whether it's spiders or, you know, snakes or agoraphobia going out. Phobias are a sort of aversion attraction. But prejudices, bigotry, things that we get addicted to hating are also attractions. Okay? Don't you know people that just seem to be addicted to some things that they don't like? Don't you know people that are just sort of fixated on whoever they think is causing everything to go wrong? Don't you know people that are sort of addicted to their hostilities around certain people or certain kinds of people? Or one might even suggest, if one were to be so bold, that our politics these days is framed on that, isn't it? That people cultivate aversion addictions, right? That's what certain kinds of political operatives do. Teach people to see those people, whoever's not on my team, but that doesn't matter which team you're on. People who are really good at this cultivate aversion addictions to the other side. Let's make you afraid, because if you're afraid, then that's a stress. You're going to seek some solution to your stress. It's straightforward addiction, right? You have a stress. I induce the stress by making you afraid of those people. I relieve your stress by lifting up my people, my program, my agenda. And next thing you know, I've cultivated a real aversion addiction in you, right? It's exactly how it works. And we're about to see that play out in a spectacular way in the next however many months, 16 months or so, right? So watch that and see how interesting it is. See how people, it doesn't matter which team you're on, everybody doesn't. See how people cultivate an aversion addiction with the same kinds of dynamics that you're talking about. God isn't more obvious? That's a question that people ask me all the time, and I actually used to wonder, but I worked for God. God is my boss. Remember Charlie's Angels? Sounds like a non sequitur, but it's not. Charlie's Angels was a show, I don't know, about 20, 25 years ago, where these three women are detectives, and you know, they're sort of glamorous. But their boss is Charlie, and the thing is, you never see Charlie. That's the point. You never see Charlie's face. What's it called? Home Improvement, the neighbor, right? The neighbor in the tool time, you never see his face. God is kind of like that, you know? God is your boss, but you never actually see God. God is like Charlie. He's your boss, but you never actually see him. So you might ask, well, look, if we have all these addictions and we're subject to them, and frail as we are, we fall for them easily, how come God isn't more conspicuous? I mean, that's a fair question, sort of an obvious question. May has an interesting answer to that, which I've actually heard other people say too, but I think he puts it pretty well. He says, God remains somewhat hidden from us. Why? Well, for one thing, God in immanence, that's to say, the God within us and around us, is already too close to us, too intimate, too much at one with us to be a clear-cut object. That makes sense. If God is as close to you as the air you breathe, then God is not an object like a cup. You can see a cup, you can deal with a cup. God being as imminent as God is within us, through us, all around us, is not an object that we can readily understand. And God in transcendence is too great to comprehend. God creates the vast expanse of the heavens, that's way too big. So God is both too intimate and imminent and too transcendent and distant to be readily perceived. That's one reason. But another reason is what God wants from us, and this is even more important, what God wants from us is to be loved, right? Love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, love your neighbor, and stuff. Well, think about it. If God, in all God's beauty, power, splendor, awesomeness, attractiveness, simply appeared unmediated, unfiltered to us, and if we were at all open to God, we'd be completely overwhelmed by that. God would become sort of another addiction. It would be a reflex, almost, to love God, to respond to God. Meaning, there would be no choice in it. God would be absolutely irresistible, and there would be no requirement of our will to choose that. You just respond like a reflex, right? Somebody hits your knee, your leg goes out, you see God in all God's fullness and beauty and attractiveness, you would just reflexively respond to that. But what God wants is love, and love is always intentional. Love always chooses. Love always says, I could have had this, but I choose that. I could have been with her, I choose to be with you. I could have been with him, I choose to be with you. I could have done that, I choose to do this. Right? Love is always a matter of choice. So, God cannot overwhelm us so that we respond only reflexively. God has to draw us by giving us gifts that point to God's goodness, by redeeming our shortcomings that point to God's grace, and gradually drawing us into the place where we say, I could have done that. I could have chosen this, but I choose you. I choose you to be my first love. And then I will order all my other loves after my love for you. When you think about it, that's the only way a being as overwhelmingly beautiful and commanding and attractive as God could possibly woo creatures like us. C.S. Lewis says, he cannot ravish, he can only woo. God has to romance us, because if God came out full force, he would simply reflexively respond, and that would not be right. I think it's kind of interesting, which is one reason why this whole life of faith is such an ongoing thing, why it's a bit of a struggle and a challenge. Another word about human love and God's love never going to stop it, okay? May says, not surprisingly, God's love is more constant than human love. Think about human love. He says it has its pure moments. Yes, it is. My love achieves pure moments, I would say 30, 40, 60 seconds at a time. I can be purely loving, with no self-serving motive at all. But then, he goes on to say, even in the best of situations, human love is bound to become intermingled with attachment. Remember, the the thing that you nail your desire to, that's an attachment. So when this happens, we can feel possessive of our loved ones. Anybody ever heard about that feeling? Maybe you've read about it. You love somebody, you just want to possess, control what that person does. You get jealous, he starts paying attention to somebody else, you want to rein her in, he starts talking to her, and you want to say, well, what were you talking to that woman like that? He becomes possessive, he becomes jealous when people don't meet our needs. You ever notice how quickly love turns to anger and hate? You disappoint me, I hate you, right? How many times do people go to turn on a dime from professions of great love to professions of anger and hatred? Why? Because our loves all tend to be intermingled with attachments. Because, as he points out, we tend to see our loved ones as extensions of ourselves. And we want them to live out our fantasies, to conform to our desires, to meet our needs, to provide us with our security and our sense of worth. So the degree to which we can feel or express authentic love is always conditional upon such attachments. Well, maybe some of you are a whole lot better than I am at this. I'm going to tell you, I did that description pretty well. Human loves are almost always wrapped around with other attachments. Attachments to the things we want from somebody, attachments to the person themselves, and when we don't get what we want, we can react in very bad ways. Next point is, we need to recognize that about our human loves. We also need to recognize that God's love is not like that. God's love is always free. God's love is always gracious. God's love is always without attachment. God's love wants simply for us to love and grow and thrive in Christ. Which, on the one hand, is why it's so hard to appreciate the love of God, because our experience of love is always so conditional and wrapped around with attachments in the way we see it every day. But on the other hand, it's also why grace is our hope to end early again. Because when our addictions fail us, as they inevitably must, space can be created where grace can come in. And when that grace does come in, we find what our hearts have been longing for the whole time, which is the love of God that is not conditional, that is always there, and always invites us. That's it for today. Come back next week, and we'll talk about the church community and the larger community. Thanks.